Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the joint session of the Council of Citizens with Low Vision and the Committee on Access and Transportation. And I'm Gene Lozano, the chair of the Committee on Access and Transportation. To my left is Bernice Kandarian, the president of the California Council of Citizens with Low Vision. We'll just see if we have some opening comments, and I will let Bernice first speak, and then I will make a few comments. Bernice?
Good morning and welcome, everyone. Gene has put together another stellar program, and I really appreciate the low vision input into the issues that come before this group.
Okay. Thank you. Now, I just want to let you know about those of you who have been going through the program that you will find that we tried something. It did not cover 100% everything, but we tried to acquire from the general session presenters as well as some of the breakout sessions vitas on the various people and to put them into the program so that you would have that information, so you'd be a little more acquainted with their backgrounds, and that also could reduce the introductory opening comments so that more time could be spent in the presentations. We have, just to let you know about that, and then the Committee on Access and Transportation will be having a business session at approximately 4:15 this afternoon. And two of the things we'll be talking about is looking at some new prototype font style tactile that's being considered for ANSI A117, and it's based on a European font. The other thing is that the Division of State Architect is going before the California Building Standards Commission on April 18th at 10 a.m. and during the commission's regular standard meeting, and one of the things they're going to be talking about is emergency adoption of some standards to bring the California Building Code into compliance with the ADA design guidelines of 2010. And of interest to us will have to do with accessible signage, the font style proportions, and the other thing is the mounting height of the signs. So please come to that, and the room is the Bayside room right across from the lobby, this lobby here. So just to give you some advertisement. Okay. This morning, the first presentation will be from staff from the Access Infrastructure, ADA Access Infrastructure of the Caltrans, to give us an update on many things that are going on in Caltrans that would be of interest to us. And we do have with us the ADA, the statewide ADA coordinator, Alex Morales, and then Cherie. You're going to have
Cherie
to say.
Cherie's fine.
Okay. And who's the ADA project manager there at the ADA Access Infrastructure. So I'm going to first turn it over to Alex, and then we'll go from there.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody, for inviting us here. And it's a privilege, really, and an honor to be here. We're going to be covering a few things, but I'd like to just give a little brief background on where I've been for the last 20-some years. I've been in the civil rights movement or the areas of civil rights all my life during my career. For the last 10-11 years, I've been with the Department of Transportation and recently with the ADA Infrastructure Program as the statewide ADA coordinator. And I'm going to turn this over to Cherie.
Thanks, Alex. Gene, again, thank you very much for inviting us or giving us the opportunity to be here. We are also, like Alex mentioned, we feel honored and privileged to be here. A brief background about me. I'm a civil engineer. I've been working for the California Department of Transportation for a little over 21 years. And I have gone through the various sections or various programs within Caltrans, from planning, design, to all the way into construction. And for the past 5.5 months, I've been working as the program manager for the ADA infrastructure program that was created within Caltrans. As we go through the presentation, I will share a little bit more about how Caltrans is set up when it comes to dealing with this subject. But just to give you a brief outline of what we plan to share with you is briefly talk about the settlement agreement that we had, talk about the grievance process that we have recently established to intake access request on Caltrans infrastructure. We'll talk about a temporary handbook that we developed to allow pedestrians access in construction area, the temporary work zones. We also briefly will cover the accessible pedestrian signal policy that was recently issued by Caltrans. And finally, kind of give you, we'll leave you with the structure of how Caltrans is set up, so it would help you in bringing issues and bringing ideas and suggestions to us. So with that, I think I'll hand it back to Alex, where he can briefly talk about the settlement agreement and the process.
Thank you, Sri. I just wanted to start off by giving you a little history of what has happened and what's been going on. As many of you know, that the there was a class action lawsuit brought against the Department of Transportation by the California Disability Rights, CCB, and several other people that were named in this lawsuit. The allegement was that the Caltrans had failed to remove barriers and ensure accessibility at existing pedestrian facilities and park and ride facilities throughout California. And this was in a violation of Title II of the ADA and also Section 504 of the Rehab Act. And again, you know, this lawsuit really brought forth a lot of positive things to the department, not only because we recognized that there was a failure out there. We recognized that we needed to move and we needed to do things that would make accessibility a lot more compliant for people that are out there using our pedestrian facilities. One of the things that we did also was to, as Sri mentioned earlier, we created this ADA infrastructure program that totally concentrates and is totally, it's in place in the department to make sure that these things are being followed and they're being recognized. Within the terms of the settlement, there was some things that were included. Of course, one of them was the $1.1 billion to be spent over a period of 30 years to improve access on sidewalks and pedestrian facilities. And these are broken down now. When I say $1.1 billion, I'm saying this is a base because we do have other things that we do with ADA that we're constructing. So these are figures that are for the existing facilities that we need to improve. As many of you know, that new construction has to be compliant to begin with. So these are the extra steps that we're taking that we're gonna make sure that things are being built and are being out there set up for compliance. There was other things that were mentioned. We are, as the funds are being used to improve programs, improvements, we're upgrading our sidewalks, crosswalks, park and ride facilities. These projects are being funded through the ADA. Actually, our department's funding the programs here because it is crucial that we meet these requirements. We also had the temporary route zones, which Sri will cover that. And then, of course, the access complaint process, a grievance process. And that's something that I'm going to talk about in the grievance process, because it's important that one of the things that we found out while we were looking at this is that even though we did have an access request or grievance process out there, it wasn't effective, and we recognized that because during the litigation or during the lawsuit, we had quite a few interviews and things that we went out and discussed with people out there that were using this procedure, and it wasn't successful at all. So what we did is we went out and hired some experts on ADA to help us create a more effective grievance process that would give the opportunities to the complainants a resolution. And one of the things during this time when we were looking at this, we definitely noticed that one of the main objectives to creating this grievance process was an effective communication with the complainant and with the department. And that's something that was not really happening. There was too many, as I say, hands in the cookie jar, and there wasn't really an area or a point of contact where we could be effective. So with this, a grievance process has been developed, and we're going to give you some information on that, on how to access it and things, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how it works. In the grievance process that we have, first of all, the people that were hired to help us create this effective process is a group by the name of the ADA Accessibility Consultants. They're the ADAC group, and this group was hired because of the experience they had and the knowledge they had on dealing with grievance and access. Also because there was an area where we, as I mentioned earlier, the effectiveness of being communicative with the complainant and making sure that they're involved in the process all the way from the beginning to the end. And so with that, we were able to produce and create a grievance process that would take us through an intake in which you can access it through our web page. And in our web page, you can find the area in which it talks about access. If you have an access complaint, access request, you can access this, and it'll take you to an intake form. And this intake form, what it does, it just asks you questions on what is your request, what is the access request, and what is needed. In the intake form also, it tells you how to submit it, the date of the event, the location, and near. What's very exciting about this new procedure or grievance process is that the consultants, prior to taking on this this responsibility, as they had done an assessment of all our right-of-way on non-compliant areas, and they were able to put this in our transition plan, in which when you actually go out there and submit an intake form, there is an area where it can identify the area that has been already assessed, which is a plus. Because with that, what we do is when they validate it and they make sure that everybody's being talked to, because when you submit a complaint, it's either going to be on a state property or it's going to be on a local municipality. And so this is where we have to really make sure that the validation or who is responsible, and then we start the investigation. During the investigation, we do an investigation on the area that's being questioned, and make sure that the consultants and our engineers are out there looking at these areas to make sure that it is a complaint that is within our responsibility. And if it's not, I'm not saying if it's not under responsibility, we're not going to take action. We sure will. If it's even in the local municipality, we will be coordinating with the locals and making sure that these are being covered. The post-investigation is going to be, first of all, talking to the grievant, talking to the complainant, to make sure that we get everything down that the person is requesting. Okay, so that we can understand. Sometimes when you submit an intake form, it's not really saying everything that the complainant is wanting to address. So we make the call and we make sure that we are talking to the complainant. In this process, there is timelines. In these timelines, we're following actually the Department of Justice grievance timelines, but we have made it a requirement that our consultants expedite these complaints in a timely manner, where we're constantly talking to the complainant. When there is a decision being made, the complainant will know about it. When there is a resolution, being made. The complainant will know about it throughout this whole process. The complainant will be in communication. As you go into the actual intake, you're going to submit the form, and you're going to send it to, it's going to go directly to my office or the unit, and I'm going to get it, and also the consultants will get it. When they submit, complain and submit, we both are going to look at it at the same time. The consultants will provide the investigation, and then we'll be in communication. During that time, we're also going to be looking at the communication with the complainant and making sure that the complainant is being addressed. Validation of the complaint is very important because we want to make sure that we are not going out there and looking at an area that the complainant did not say this is the area. That we want to make sure this is exactly where the complainant or the access request came in. When we do that, the consultants will come up with what we call a recommended resolution. In this recommended resolution, there's going to be the area identified. There's going to be the measurements and everything that's been taken. And then we're going to meet. They're going to meet with me, with the ADA coordinator, and we're going to go over this recommended resolution with an engineer. And then we're going to call the areas, because we're made up of 12 districts. So whichever in any area they come, the complaint comes in, we're going to make sure that we're in communication. And then when we reach an agreement with this recommended resolution, the complainant will be sent a notification saying, this is the proposed resolution. What do you think about it? And if the complainant says, okay, I agree, then we move forward, okay? And this whole process that we have constructed, our main focus really is to make sure that the respondent is being communicated. And I stress that a lot, because during the time when we were assessing and looking at our process, that was a failure, really, that the respondent, the person accessing the request was not being communicated. So we want to make sure that this information is being brought to the respondent. Another thing is also, we also have in our office four individuals that are very, they're experts in ADA, in a sense that we can definitely address these issues. So I want to stress to all of you that if you ever run into a situation where you're not satisfied, please give me a call, give the office a call, and we will move on it as quick as we can. Within this process, we also have a transition plan that's in effect that, again, as I mentioned earlier, when you submit this complaint or this request, there is a plan out there that identifies these areas. And these areas are located within a map, and then we can actually identify and send the people out there and make sure that these are being addressed. Also, when the investigation process is done and everybody's satisfied, we will make sure that in talking to the department, if it's an investigation, what we're doing is we're requiring that all ADA complaints that come in are priority to us. They're made priority to make sure that if we can get things done right away, we will. But again, as many of you know, sometimes, you know, if there's projects being set up that have already been identified, there's many times that the department has identified an area, but the complainant really doesn't know. We will let them know that there has been a project identified there that will be breaking ground soon, as soon as we can get the project going. Okay? In this whole process, I just want to assure you that the ADA infrastructure program is out there. It's a new division that is within Caltrans to make sure that everything that is addressed in ADA, be it a complaint, be it construction, be it a design, be it whatever it has to do, that we are monitoring this and we are making sure that everything is getting done in a timely manner, and that we're meeting. Our main goal is to meet our compliance and to make sure that we're addressing every issue that's coming in within the department. And with that, there's a few other things that Tree is going to talk about. that's going to touch a little bit about this also. Is there any questions? Oh, okay. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Okay. So as we go through this this grievance process, I would like for you guys to take an opportunity when you have an opportunity, get into our webpage and go through that process and look at it. And the webpage is in, it's www.dot.ca.gov.
Basically, it's the Caltrans website, the homepage. When you go to the Caltrans homepage, on the top, you'll find multiple tabs. And one of the tabs there, it says Contact Us. And the Contact Us will give you a link to enter the information. It'll give you the link to the access request page. So please try that, and any feedback you can provide us on that, how useful was it, or how useful is it, or if we need to make any modifications to it, please do not hesitate to let us know. We'll try to do whatever we can to make it more accessible. Okay. So we'll move on to the next item. This is Sri again with Caltrans, and as I mentioned, I'm the program manager. What Alex covered so far is the what we call as the front end or the initial process, basically to bring the issue or the subject matter to our attention. The next step on this is to take care of the shortcoming or the issue, and that would be the project development process or completing a project to finish this. Now, these facilities or these access constraints or restraints could be on either our property, that is Caltrans jurisdiction. It could be on private property, or it could be in the city or county. What we have attempted to do, or what we are attempting to do, is no matter where this shortcoming is or this accessibility issue is, please enter that information into the system, and we will take over from there. What we plan to do is, and what we are actually doing right now, is as soon as we get a notice that something needs to be done, we determine who has the jurisdiction over that area and then contact that person. If it is a city, we write a letter to the city and give them all the requirements that they are supposed to meet. And if it's a private entity, we send them a letter saying that, hey, this is something that was brought to our attention, and by law, you're required to address that. So we will make them aware of this and then follow through with them. The whole idea is to start off with a request from a requester and then get back to them and finish the cycle. So that's the plan. So I'll briefly go through what we are doing at Caltrans as far as our project delivery process. Usually it takes quite a while to get a project through in Caltrans because of the various phases we have to go through. You start off with the planning phase. You have to go through the environmental clearance. Even for every job, we have to go through the environmental clearance. Some projects are much faster than the other, but we have to go through it, and we will try to expedite those in the projects that the ADA infrastructure program is dealing with. But once a project goes into construction, one of the things that we have remissed in the past is to talk about the temporary access or access in temporary construction zones. And so we have come up with a handbook to educate our employees, our construction field employees, to see what kind of setup they need to have to make the construction zones or the work zones accessible on a temporary basis. So we issued the handbook late last year, and we have also conducted training on that. We have had about 1,000 of our employees across the state trained on it, and it's a continuous process. Whenever somebody has a project that deals with pedestrian infrastructure, they are required to go through this training. They're required to get a certificate saying that they have successfully completed this training so that they are aware of the things that they need to do in a temporary project site to make sure that the project site is accessible to pedestrians. So we are going to continue to do that. as we are training our construction folks, we're also training our design employees to make sure that when they design these facilities, either for temporary work zone areas or on a permanent basis, they are aware of various factors that they need to take into account. So the projects that are coming out should be accessible. And finally, the people who maintain it, we want to make sure that they know what they should be doing during maintenance and also as they maintain the infrastructure. Again, the key thing is to make our infrastructure program accessible. One of the recent things that I mentioned as far as accessibility is also our accessible pedestrian signals. We have issued a policy memo that says any new pedestrian signal installation, any pedestrian crossings on the state highway system should have the pedestrian countdown timers and the accessible pedestrian system signal installed. This is for any new system. And then within the next 3 years, by December 2014, we plan to have all of our signals APS compliant. So that is our goal. The total work done should be by December 31st, 2014, we should have all of our signals with the accessible pedestrian signal system installed. And that policy directive was sent out last month. And one of the things we made sure in the past, the coordination effort has been little difficult or little broken. So that's why we established, even though we had the Alex's position, the statewide ADA coordinator, because most of this thing, the issues that we are dealing with is in the infrastructure part, that is our sidewalks, our curb ramps, we had that brought in under the ADA infrastructure program. So there is one single focal point for all the ADA issues now, and that would be Alex. So any issues that you have, please bring it to his attention, and then we will work through it to make sure it gets to the right group within Caltrans to make sure the issues are addressed. At this time, I'll briefly cover the way we are set up. Just like I mentioned, Alex is the ADA coordinator working for the ADA infrastructure program, and we are based out of headquarters in Sacramento. But we have 12 districts, or California is broken into 12 districts for Caltrans. And our process is the headquarters are in Sacramento, we set up the policy, and the districts implements the policy, implements the project. So we have, in headquarters, we have the ADA coordinator. I'm the project manager for projects, our program manager, and I have a couple of program advisors who work for me. Then we have, in the districts, in each of the 12 districts, we have an ADA engineer who deals with the technical aspects of the construction work that needs to be done or the projects, and then we have the ADA liaison who deals with the civil rights aspect of it. So even in the districts, we are covered, and even in headquarters, we are covered. We deal with, we have a local agency, a group within Caltrans that deals with any local agency projects, i.e. if there is an issue in a city or our county, we can talk to them. We have a hammer on them in the form of their funding, because the funding from Federal Highway Administration goes through us to them. So if we're having some issues there, we can definitely talk to them and try to convince them to do the right thing. So that issue will be taken care of by the local agency group. And then we also have the FHWA that we work with very closely, the Federal Highway Administration. Now, the Federal Highway Administration is tasked by the U.S. Department of Transportation, USDOT, to make sure all state departments of transportation follow the law, law to the letter. And then they get their authority from the Department of Justice. So there is a direct line from the Department of Justice all the way down to the local level to make sure the projects are compliant. So to make sure these things flow smoothly, we have established an ADA steering committee within Caltrans. This consists of all the various groups within Caltrans that deals with either design, planning, and meeting with the locals, getting it constructed, getting the facilities maintained. So we have a steering committee that we meet frequently to make sure that everybody's on the same page, because that was one of the things that was missing in the past, is that you go to talk to one group, they give you one answer, you go talk to another group, you may get a different answer. To avoid that, we have this committee that we meet and make sure everybody's on the same page, everybody understands where things are kind of slowing down or falling down, and in those cases, we make sure we pull them back up. And at the same time, we also have an external group that kind of advises us, the external task group, and CCB is part of that group. We need to make sure that what we are doing is compatible and is acceptable to the public. So we are making sure we get that kind of input also. We are also working, like for example, recently we worked with Donna on trying to get our safety roadside rest area, get her input on what we can do there to make it more accessible, and we will continue to have those kind of interactions to make sure we get the latest information and make sure we are able to serve the community well. In conclusion, I would like to say that Caltrans is actively involved and will continue to do so. Our objective, at least of the ADA infrastructure program, is to make sure the Caltrans infrastructure is equally accessible to persons with disabilities. We want to make sure that the process is smooth, the process is less frustrating than it has been in the past, and we'll do our best to make sure we address these issues as quickly as we can within the constraints that we have to work with. What we have done is we have set up a small demonstration outside. We have a barricade. One of our contractors who has worked with us on various projects, Capital Barricade, has set up a small barricade system outside that you can probably, when you get a chance, go out and take a look at it. It's accessible. It's available from right now and all the way up to around 1 o'clock. You can go take a look at it and see and give your feedback on your thoughts about it. And also, please feel free to contact us. I think Alex has his cards available here that he can, if you have any questions now or if you come up with any questions later, you can go, you can contact us and Joe Reel, who is outside setting up the demonstration, he can take your input too, so feel free to give that. And once again, I really want to thank Gene and the entire group for giving us the opportunity to be here and share some of the things that we're doing. And there are many things that are in progress that you'll see down the road, but at least we wanted to give you an idea of where we are headed towards. And any input, any feedback, we will be glad to take them and see how we can incorporate that. So once again, thank you very much for allowing us to be part of your convention today.
Thank you, Sri. I'm going to ask first, Alex, if you could, so it's out there, that your contact information, if you could tell everyone so they could take it down so they know how to get focal point, any complaints or praise or whatever.
That certainly. The information for my contact information, my direct line, if anybody wants to contact me, it's area code 916-653-4913. And also, as we mentioned earlier, in our grievance procedures, our new grievance process, in that in our access page, web page, you will find my name and all my information on there also. So those are two areas you can contact me. And anytime, do not hesitate.
Okay. I'm going to ask the first question, clarification, about the APS policy, which sounds like right now any new installations, the signals are going to be equipped with an APS. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. Any new signals that we are going to be installing will have the APS. And also, any signals that we're working on, if we're making more than 50% of changes in the, say, the signal heads or the pedestrian push buttons, we'll make them also APS compatible.
Okay. And then if it's 50-50 with the locals, and that's where your area will work out the issues that might arise where locals may not want to put them in or not?
Correct. We definitely, like I mentioned, with FHWA giving us the authority or holding us responsible for making sure all the DOTs, whether it's at the state level or at the local city and county level, they have asked us to kind of keep an eye out and bring to their attention anything that we need to bring to their attention. So we will definitely talk to the locals because we are their partners, they are our partners, we'll talk to them, and then, if need be, elevated higher to FHWA. And we have a local assistance group within Caltrans that works extensively with the local community, local agencies, the cities and counties, on various aspects of transportation. And this would be one of the things that they would address.
Okay, and then the last part of it, just want to be certain I understood, that you're shooting for the end of 2015.
2014, December 31st, 2014, we would like to get 100% of the signalized locations
throughout the whole
implement,
state?
Yes. This is to implement the, this is, no, this is to implement the walking speed. And also APS, too. We'll try to get the APS in.
Okay.
And I forgot to mention the other one is the walking speed that we have tried to establish also.
Okay, and that's very important. But you're trying to shoot for the APS at all the existing Caltrans signals throughout the state by 2014?
That is the intent.
The intent.
Yes.
Okay. Do we have a microphone out there? And I was just hoping we might have somebody might help get it. We have a few questions. Wait.
If you have a question, could you please stand and I'll bring the mic to you? When I bring the mic to you, could you please state your name? And I just knocked over something.
And I think I heard Mitch first. There was several people wanting.
Well, thank you, Gene. It's Mitch Pomerantz, and as I said to Alex earlier, I am the retired ADA compliance officer for the city of Los Angeles. And I had, listening to the part of the presentation, I was having a flashback to about 10 years ago when I got a request from a constituent who wanted an APS at Lincoln and Venice in Los Angeles. And after we went out and did a survey, we determined, and it took a couple of weeks for our Department of Transportation to even know that that intersection was under Caltrans jurisdiction. And, you know, we're the folks who are supposed to know these things. Is it easier now to ascertain for the average person which intersection or what intersection is under whose jurisdiction? Because, you know, my vague recollection is that you have jurisdiction on certain intersections that lead to freeways, and even for those of us who are in the biz, it can be real confusing. So is it now a lot easier to be able to figure out in a timely manner who's responsible for what intersection?
We have not made anything significantly different on the as far as trying to identify under whose jurisdiction what comes in. What we have done is in the past people have not didn't know how to get that information even within Caltrans because each there are a lot of arrangements that we have with cities and counties where in some cases we actually have the jurisdiction as far as the owning of the property or owning of the land. But then it turns, we turn around and have like a maintenance agreement that somebody else takes care of it. So there is a lot of those kind of situations that constantly change. For example, we relinquish a portion of the highway, then we take it back or we keep it, and then we have somebody else take care of it. So it's kind of, there is no single system that you can just kind of go in and enter this information and get that answer immediately. But what we have done is made sure the ADA engineer in each district is aware of this situation. So as soon as access request comes in, our access consultants take that information, put it on a map, and identify that location and sends it to our ADA engineer in the district directly and says, can you identify whose jurisdiction this particular location is under? And what they do is they go to a right-of-way division and they can look at our right-of-way maps and get that information. So have we changed the way we do it? And I wouldn't say we have changed the entire way of how we record it, but what we have certainly done is have everybody educated and everybody informed that we need to keep these records up to date and then where you go get that information.
As just a quick follow-up, will that information, is that information also readily available to folks in municipalities and counties if, for example, somebody calls their local traffic engineer in the city of Los Angeles? Will that person be able to know in a timely manner whether that's a Caltrans intersection or a city intersection?
In many cases, they should, because they should keep the same records as we would in our right-of-way department, because if they have to manage it, they need to know what portion of the transportation infrastructure they have to manage. So they should have that information, and in some cases they do, in some cases they don't. But at least the control that we have is on our business process and our facility. So we are trying to get at least our portions done. So if you have, if you encounter a situation where you're not getting that answer, then please feel free to contact Caltrans, and we will certainly try to help out. Again, if we get hundreds and thousands of calls, then certainly it'll take a little bit of time, but we'll definitely try to expedite it.
Okay. We could take probably about two questions. Okay, and that's unfortunately it. Okay.
My name is Warren Cushman, and three of us moved to the Bay Area in the East Bay 2 years ago. We live on East 14th and Ashland Avenue. We found out as soon as we got to our apartment that we live in a Caltrans area, and we contacted Caltrans. We fell into a black hole. We tried to work with Caltrans for almost 2 years to get an audible pedestrian signal in our intersection. It's unsafe, and we were not able to cross our intersection without an APS. Finally, we contacted our County Board of Supervisors, and our supervisor's staff was actually able to begin the process of working with Caltrans. So I'm hoping, again, our intersection is East 14th and Ashland Avenue. I'm hoping that we can move forward with an APS on that intersection, because at this point we can't cross it.
Yes, if you have contacted them and if they're working with us, we'll also work with them to make sure we can try to get those things done as quickly as possible. Please also share that information with us, and we can follow up on it to figure out where it stands.
Okay. So last one.
This is Charlene Arnellis. And what I wanted to know, you mentioned the timing, the walk timing. Could you define what that's going to end up being? And for some people may not know what that is. Would you tell us what it is?
Right now, the walk time to cross an intersection or to go through a crosswalk from one side to another, it can be anywhere from 3.5 to 4 feet per second. What we have done is, as a part of this policy that we have issued, it is brought down to 3.5 feet per second. And if for some reason it needs to be lowered, then with proper justification and notification, we can reduce it further.
Thank you very much. And I want let's give our representatives from Caltrans a big hand, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And they do have a demonstration outside across the lobby that is under the cover, so you shouldn't run into any rain. And I'm under the belief that the volunteers have been notified as to the location. So I'm not asking for a mass exodus right now, but I think you said 1 o'clock, around 4 o'clock, because
yeah.
That's what we had.
Yeah, 1 o'clock.
1 o'clock, okay. Okay, That's fine. Just that we get the word out. 1 o'clock. So give the feedback, and you're welcome to stay here. Okay. We're going to move on to the next thing to do with shared streets, or as we've also known as under other names, shared spaces, shared uses. A little back in, I think, 2006, we had Scott Winley from the U.S. Access Board came in, conducted a workshop to get our input on the idea of streets where there'd be no traffic control devices, sidewalks at all, and it would be mixed use of bicyclists, motorists, and pedestrians, and kind of it's a design from Europe, and we're going to hear a little more detail update on that. And you may also recall that in 2009 we passed resolution 2009B4 on the shared streets concept and making some recommendations. We have invited representatives from the city of San Francisco who are going to be on a panel for us on the various things San Francisco has been doing to implement this. We have a moderator, it's Chris Downey, who is an architect who has been involved in this process, working with the city, that is going to give you an overview, the historical, and letting you know some things that he knows updated nationally. Internationally, and I believe that after the panel, just we will have because it was a focus group they had, and is Beth here right now?
Yeah.
Good. And we will have hear about the focus group from that perspective at the end user. So, Chris, I'm going to turn it over to you and leave it up to your judgment as to when you may want to have some of the questions. I know there's going to be a lot of them, so you may want to break it up into segments. So it's all yours, Chris.
Okay. I would like to, hi everybody. This is Chris Downey. It's nice to be here.
Get on the mic.
Is it on? Can you hear me? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So before I get too far away here, Gene, how are we on time? And what's our...
We got into about 11 o'clock.
Okay. And how's that with you, Scott Paul?
That works.
Okay. So, so I had about 15 minutes for my introduction and sort of talk on this. And I'll set my timer, get that going.
Get closer to that mic again.
Okay. Come on. Okay, so I've set my timer here, and it's a barking dog when it's time for me to quit. So if you all get a little irritated and you have a guide dog, just give him the nudge, and I'll move on to the question and answers. So anyway, I'm an architect, and this issue came up to me about the same time the CCB was addressing the issue in 2009. But through separate circles. And what was interesting from my perspective is that I've been an architect and had over 20 years of experience, and then 2 years, well, actually a year and a half prior to that time, had just lost all my sight. So I started responding to the issue of shared streets, both as an architect and also as a newly blind traveler. And the two make for a fairly interesting mix. On one hand, as an architect, I'm the eternal optimist and the believer that with good thinking and good process, you can solve all sorts of problems and get to a good workable solution. And that's where a lot of creativity comes in. On the other hand, I was blind and walking the streets, and the prospects of environments where there were no curbs and there was a notion of sort of shared space with all sorts of ambiguity that seemed a little terrifying. And shared a comment with someone who was sort of introduced that concept to me that, you know, thinking about a Saturday morning in a shared street with a parent, you know, a mother or father driving their SUV, hopefully not a hybrid, with a car full of kids going off to soccer practice, having their morning coffee and texting on their iPhone. It's a rather scary proposition, and I wasn't the least bit interested. Nevertheless, it's worth looking back where this came from. And it wasn't a notion of how to change, a frivolous notion of how to change the street environment just for some whimsical purpose. It actually started in the 80s in Europe, in Holland, in the Netherlands. And it was being promoted by the person who came up with the basic idea, Hans Mondermann. And his observation was that, ironically, that drivers were more affected by the environment around them than they were by the traffic controls. And many of you have probably experienced that. If you have streets that are designed exclusively for cars and fast travel, and there's all sorts of space, you can put up any speed sign you want, and people, it doesn't matter. They'll drive what's comfortable for them. The environment dictates what feels like a comfortable speed, and they won't necessarily pay that much attention to the speed limit. Anyway, that plays out in urban spaces as well, that the space really has a tremendous effect on how drivers perceive their safety at various speeds and naturally find their comfort zone. So with that, he started sort of evolving the way to think about sort of urban streets. At that time in Europe, pedestrian streets were very common, very popular, and those were streets where there were no cars. The streets were turned over exclusively to pedestrians and cyclists. And it was very successful, but at the same time, it completely excluded the car. And that had some impact on businesses, on the ability to sort of create successful urban spaces. And it was also, there was either the either-or situation. You had cyclists and pedestrians, or you had cars and a little bit of the others. So this was an attempt to try to create a more multi-purpose space, and quite frankly, also to look at the urban space where so much of our cities were being turned over to cars. Prior to the car, you could walk pretty much throughout the street space. It was shared more with the horses and different things going on, but there's a lot more overlap. With the advent of the car, more and more of the city space had been turned over exclusively to the cars and the few trespassers that would go across it, and more of the drivers and fewer of the pedestrians. With urban design, the preference is to get people out of the cars and have more successful urban spaces and to turn over more space to the people, to the pedestrians, as opposed to the cars. So that was sort of what was pushing for this new approach to city streets. And it's as much about the character of the space, but also who all's using it, the control of speeds, trying to get cars to slow down and respect the sort of the urban setting. So that was in the 80s, and that went along. And for the first time, about in 1991, the term shared streets was used. Prior to that, with his work, Hans Mondermann, and in the Netherlands, it was Holland, so it was naked streets. They referred to it in Dutch as the naked streets. And the idea there was no signage. There were no lines. There's basically there's space, and you went through it and you sorted it out. These tended to be small cities, historical cities, but smaller cities, and not thoroughfares. It wasn't something they were thinking about in sort of main through streets through the town. Commercial districts were part of the focus, neighborhood settings. anyway, it then in 91 it was coined the shared streets, and it continued to grow. And throughout Europe, other countries started doing shared streets concepts. And in 2003, it was endorsed as a European cooperation initiative to actually pursue these throughout much of Europe. And they had been having great success, both in terms of creating more livable spaces, more civilized spaces, but also in actually reducing the number of accidents and injuries. Where, ironically, by having removing the street signs and creating more obstacles and having people, you know, a less segregated environment, it actually worked, where people driving cars were much more attentive, much more careful, yielded the right of way, and had a successful blending of these uses. By the time of sort of mid, say 2000, you know, shortly after 2003, there had been a number of shared streets projects built in the Netherlands, in France, in Germany, Denmark, Sweden, and then some in England, and they also started popping up, being developed in Australia and New Zealand. And they really did not have much resistance until they were being done in England. And in particular, they started stretching how they were used in England, and in particular, some of the biggest resistance came in areas where they were trying to mitigate the issues of overpopulation of pedestrians coming and going through subway stations and through very busy areas and plazas with cars and things. And what was happening is there were too many pedestrians, and they were spilling off the sidewalks and into the plazas and taking over some of the car space. So the engineers, they just put up huge, you know, barricades to separate them so you couldn't go off the sidewalk and into the street. And so they ended up with a whole series of barricades lining these areas. The problem was then the cyclists were inside the vehicular space, and they were getting run into these barricades by the truck drivers and cars and getting pinned in and getting their pedals, wheels stuck in these barricades, and all sorts of problems were happening. So they were hitting sort of critical mass in their space. And then they proposed just to do away with the curb and the barricade and let people sort it out. There was all sorts of resistance to that. The engineers weren't too happy. A lot of their tried and trusted systems were abandoned, thrown out. And then secondly, the Guide Dogs Association in the UK took notice of this and were really concerned in an environment of a unified surface as an environment to negotiate and to stay where you're supposed to be, stay safe, stay away from the cars. And the only delineation at that point was a white line. And how on earth is a guide dog supposed to know what that white line means, much less how can you find it with a cane? Well, interestingly enough, in the UK, the guide dogs have tremendous pull. The Guide Dogs Association. Turned out the most popular kids show in Europe, one of the most popular kids shows in England, is a show called Blue Peter. I don't know if anybody knows about that. I don't, other than this little story. And it's a long-running show that still runs today. And on this show, they train guide dogs. I don't know if it's part of the show or an interlude, but they train guide dogs as part of this show. And all the kids throughout England save aluminum foil to recycle to raise money through the Blue Peter program to raise money to train guide dogs. So the guide dogs have huge following, huge support, and they got great traction to the point where they were actually able to stop some projects and to insist on some research and developing real solutions to the problems that were inherent in this scheme. Then at some point, I think around 2006, the CABE, the Center for Commission for Architectural and Built Environment, Architecture and Built Environment in Europe, in England. It's a government organization that we don't really have a parallel here in the United States. It's not a code agency. They're actually a government commission that works for universal design and inclusive design throughout all the built environment, not looking at code, looking beyond code to make sense in a more inclusive way of how to build a better environment. So they got involved and actually commissioned a study through the Helen Hamlin Center to really look seriously at how the blind navigate the built environment and build mental maps and understand where they are using different navigational tools, whether it's a cane, a guide dog, all sorts of different systems, and all the variations that happen within that, really to try to understand what the planners don't typically understand of how do the blind navigate, understand, and build a mental map of their environment in hopes that that could then form a foundation to better design these spaces. That went well. The first study revealed what you would expect, which was there's a lot of variation. and so no firm conclusion drew from it, but there were some things that stood out as unified tactics that could be used. Unfortunately, this was about 2010. They're having the financial crisis in Europe. Great Britain, England, they defunded the Center for Architectural and Built Environment, so CAPE was defunded, and they couldn't follow up with a second phase of research with the Helen Hamlin Center. Luckily, the London Institute for the Blind picked it up and funded a continuation of this research with the Helen Hamlin Center. And today that stands where it's almost, that research is almost announced. It's not out yet. I know the former director of CAPE, and he told me that they're being very tight-lipped, but they have some promising outlooks. So my dog's barking. So, and he's still barking. Steve Jobs has come back as a dog, and he's inside my phone. Stop it. Okay, now he's fine. So, that's good timing. The only thing else I wanted to add was that there are, to my knowledge, there's all sorts of variations on this that have happened in the United States. There are some projects within the United States that are built so far. The two that I'm confirmed that I know of is one is in West Palm Beach, Florida, and the other is in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I believe it's Winthrop Street. And I've not had the opportunity to visit either Winthrop Street. It's on my list of places to check out soon. I think that sounds like a pretty interesting area. It's a commercial area with nearby residential, so it's a fairly mixed use. And also, they say, fairly successful space. So anyway, that's it for my introduction, and I'd like to move on to the panel discussion. And there'll be plenty of opportunities for questions as we go and at the end. So please feel free to ask your questions. So on our panel today, let me make sure. Well, we have Neil Rushoy, who's with the San Francisco Planning Department. And he's had been involved with a number of projects and also, I believe, in developing some of the standards within San Francisco for the planning department. Is that correct, Neil?
Yes, that's
correct. Yes. Okay. And would you like to add anything else to your brief introduction?
No, that's perfect.
Okay. Yeah. And we also have Peter Albert.
That's right.
Is that correct? With the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Authority?
Agency.
And Could you share a little bit more about your role there and your place in this presentation?
Sure. I work with the MTA in San Francisco.
Oh,
sure.
Oh, do you not have?
Can people hear me better now? So I am Peter Albert. I work with the MTA in San Francisco, and I approached MTA about 5 years ago when my initial position was the director of planning. Since then, a couple of years into that job, the mayor's office asked me to help them with special large projects like Treasure Island or the Hunters Point Shipyard, and specifically now America's Cup. My main job is to help coordinate the transportation planning with these projects that have very aggressive time schedules and a very large development potential impact, and my work is to help mitigate those impacts.
Okay, thank you. We also have John Paul Scott from the San Francisco Mayor's Office on Disability. And John Paul Scott, what's your official title?
Hi there. I'm the Deputy Director for Physical Access. I am the person who's in charge of the city's ADA transition plan, but also do training, special projects, and large projects. I'm also the chair of the Mayor's Disability Council Physical Access Committee, which reviews large projects and provides public feedback.
Okay. Thank you, John Paul. We also have Beth Berenson. Maybe most of you already know Beth. And Beth is with the Lighthouse and is the information resource
program
coordinator with the Lighthouse. And as was introduced by Jean, she was involved with a workshop put together with the planning department and Mayor's Office on Disability to deal with shared streets. And she's also a member of CCB in the San Francisco chapter and Contra Costa chapter, if that's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So thank you. She's a late add, so we're really happy that she was willing to join us and could join us for this. I'd also like to say that John Paul Scott worked with people at the Lighthouse to create some tactile drawings to augment what we're talking about going over here today. And so there are three tactile drawings that are here, and we can pass them around for you to review during this presentation. There's also a model that John Paul Scott put together himself that is a block, city block, that demonstrates some of the different textures. He incorporated a lot of textures and elements, and they're labeled in Braille, so that you can have a sense of what's going on. Now, if possible, I hadn't had a chance to ask you this, Beth, but we'd like to leave John Paul Scott, the panel and myself, we all need to leave quickly after this presentation. Beth, if you're going to be around, we can leave these drawings in the model with you to bring back to San Francisco. That way others can check it out in more detail later if they'd like to. Does that work for you?
Can you arrange that with somebody?
I will try. I can't promise it because I can't get that on BART with my luggage.
Ah, okay. Right. Okay, so we'll see what we can do. Maybe coordinate something with Jean or somebody else if they're going back to San Francisco later.
Do you want me to hand out the plans?
Yes, let's do that. Yeah.
So there's two sheets. One sheet, the first sheet, is what we call the gateway, where we can create a gateway that slows cars down before and makes them know they've now gone into a space that has pedestrian priority. The second sheet in this set is the actual block itself. The model is very similar to what's on the second sheet, and there's Braille material. But what these sheets use is different textures, paper textures, to mean different kinds of surfacing or objects. All right? And so I'll bring one to each of the seating sections, and you can pass them around. And later on, after the meeting, you can come and work on the tactile model. We were thinking of passing that around, but it's kind of a little bit cumbersome.
And we won't be able to do that until at least noon because we have some other presenters after from 11 to 12. I'm sorry to interrupt, Chris. The one thing, since you said you'll be departing very quickly, Bernice and I both will need your business cards. Those of you, those on the panel that have business cards, we really would like to have those before you depart, please.
So, Gene, if it's okay with you, we'll just leave it here with you in faith that it'll sort out, find its way back to San Francisco somehow, between you and Beth or other people.
Okay, we'll talk about it.
Okay, so while John Paul Scott is passing that out, I'd like to go ahead and launch in with some questions. So I do have some questions prepared, and I also want to leave time for you to ask your own questions from the audience. But I'd like to start with a question for Neil, and that's just for our clarification, if you could sort of tell us the difference between a shared street, shared public way, and shared space.
Great. Thank you very much, Chris. And so just to be clear in the lexicon so we all understand what the words mean, we've come up with some concepts that help us describe and discuss this big topic of shared space. And so at the top of the list is the shared public way. And that is it's a space with a prioritized use for pedestrians over the entire right of way, and including the vehicular through travel. They can accommodate small numbers of vehicles at low speeds as necessary for local access to building entries, driveways, on-street parking, loading and service, and emergency access. And they provide clarity for people with visual impairments regarding the shared pedestrian and vehicular nature of the space. And so the shared public way is sort of the big umbrella. Underneath that, we have two other concepts, the shared street, which is a street that is or has been converted from a regular street with curbs to a shared public way, but still has the functions of the street, and is very much as Chris described it in his introduction. The shared space would be something like UN Plaza, where it's primarily a public plaza, but food trucks may come up onto it, a farmer's market for loading, unloading of the produce. And so, but it's primarily a pedestrian plaza, but on occasions there is very limited access for special events like a farmer's market, for example. And so those are the distinctions we've created to help us discuss these concepts.
Thank you, Neil. What's sort of driving this interest with the city of San Francisco and the shared streets concepts? What's really behind that?
I want to thank Chris for an outstanding introduction to this, and I think he provided a very insightful and fair and balanced description of what was really behind the shared space movement in Europe. And I think it's very similar in San Francisco. There's a sense that one quarter of our land is contained in streets. And we have a very, very limited definition of how those streets should be designed and used. And in many cases, that's probably not appropriate in some cases. You know, we would imagine that on some quiet residential streets, that it'd be great to have a much more flexible use of that right-of-way than just have vehicles moving up and down it within the curb. Isn't there some way to reconceive of that space as something that is more broadly used and even prioritizes pedestrian use and movement through that space? There are other streets where there is very, very limited use of the street by vehicles, but tremendous use by pedestrians, high volumes, and yet we maintain a very, very rigid structure of how the street is defined and the segregation of uses that isn't in character with how the people would like to use that street. And it also comes into conflict with safety. And I think, again, as Chris pointed out, there's a recognition that the rigid engineering guidelines for how we design streets really is based upon certainty of behavior. So on a freeway, you know how everyone's going to behave, or you hope everyone's going to behave. They stay in their lanes, they go a certain speed, and they don't do anything dramatic or unpredictable. In many urban environments, that certainty breaks down, and people do step off the curb, and they do things that are unpredictable, and that's one of the reasons why we have the level of accidents in North America versus Europe, that we have not come to the recognition that in urban settings there is unpredictable behavior, but we have designed streets for speed and through movement of cars, in that those, the reality and the design, come into conflict with each other. And so we're hoping that there's this intermediate way to design streets that turns it on the head, turns it on the paradigm on its head and says people are the most important. If we were to design this space for the use, comfort, and safety of people, what would it look like? And I think shared space has given some insight into what that may look like. I think we're working very hard to advance that in a way that is universally accessible and safe and navigable by everyone. But at its core, it's this desire to create streets that are designed for the priority of people versus the movement of vehicles.
Okay, thanks, Neil. And one more question for you before we move on to someone else on the panel. Actually, two more questions. The shared streets concept and elements within that have been incorporated within the planning guidelines and also been proposed on various projects within the city. Could you sort of go over what projects are currently being considered or have been considered for as a shared streets project or type project?
Certainly. And so in terms of current streets that would meet the shared space criteria, I've been able to come up with a list of 6 in the city. The majority of them are on private property. One is a public-private partnership, and 2 are public. And so Linden Alley is one of the more recent introductions of the shared space concept to a street. It's in the Market Octavia area, and it's a half a block in length, and that was done as a public-private partnership with an architect who had an office on that street and Department of Public Works. Davis Court is probably the most recent example. It's on private property in the Golden Gateway apartment area near the waterfront. And it's a closed street. It has 1 garage entrance, and it's not a through street. And it's on private property. Hotelling Place is another private property example. A third is 440 Fulton Housing, which I believe was as part of the workshop that John Paul is going to discuss. And again, that's while it does go through the block, it is a private access road, basically to access the properties of the residents on that street, and it's a very narrow street. Public ones include 2 cable car turnaround areas, Powell Street in the downtown, the Powell Street Mall between Ellis and Market. And the second is the cable car turnaround at Taylor Street in Fisherman's Wharf. And those are more sort of in the transit mall model. So the public ones have been around for a while. And right now, nothing is slated to be built within the city proper. Treasure Island is a notable exception. And Peter Albert, my colleague, is going to go into more detail about the Treasure Island designs. But right now, that's all that has been built. And I don't know of any plans to expand that list right now.
So that feeds into the final question for you, which was there was one other on the list, but it's no longer on the list, and that's Jefferson Street. And that was a project you were involved with. And so Jefferson Street is in Fisherman's Wharf. Many of you may know that. And it's a busy tourist commercial area right along the waterfront and leading into Aquatic Park. And so if you could, just sort of go over how that had evolved into a shared streets project, the consideration of transit within that, and then what the current plan is for that street. And it's also worth noting that that's a project that is somewhat central to the city's plans for the America's Cup coming up in next summer, correct? So there was a lot of pressure to push this one through quickly, and that feeds into how this all developed. So, Neil?
Great, thank you. So yeah, Jefferson Street is in Fishman's Wharf. It is a heavy destination. We went out, we counted pedestrians, and Yes, of course. Thank you. It's heavily used by pedestrians. Over 70,000 pedestrians a day walk along Jefferson Street. Very few cars use it. It is increasingly used by cyclists. And the design, however, is very much in sort of a 1950s model of very wide roadway and narrow sidewalks. And in some cases, the sidewalks may be no wider than 3 feet. In other cases, non-existent, in other cases, only 7 feet wide, and so is a far from ideal situation for pedestrians. And it's also relatively narrow. It's about 70 feet wide. And so the concept was that here's a great example of a street that could be turned on its head. It's a dead-end street. Businesses, their loading and delivery needs are largely taken care of by lunchtime, before the crowds arrive, and so that there's a time differential between when the people are there and when the vehicles are there. And instead of carving up the street into sort of more narrow slivers where everyone gets their own dedicated amount of space, we felt that that would sort of impoverish everyone because there's not enough space for everyone to get something good. And wouldn't it be great to have a design that provided more flexibility? And since the conflicts were largely mitigated because of time of day, that the shared space concept would be appropriate for Jefferson Street. And you know, that the idea was still to have two pedestrian-only zones on either side against the building edge with a shared zone in the center. All the criteria that would have gone into the Better Streets plan, fewer than 100 cars per hour, the gateway treatments, the clear delineation using visual and tactile elements between the safe pedestrian zone and the shared zone would all be put into place. But you know, these are guidelines, and as Chris mentioned, we were on a very tight time frame. We're only a couple blocks from the starting line for the America's Cup, and the anticipated number of people coming through here, we really felt we'd like to deliver the project in time, and we just needed more time to work out thoughtfully the details of how to make a shared space work. And so at the end of the day, for timing reasons and for cost, we decided that at some point in the future, we'd love to look at this again, but we are going to reintroduce the use of curbs and create much wider sidewalks, a very narrow roadway, and use more traditional methods for delineation of the spaces while still learning from our efforts in the shared space discussion. We've removed trees and therefore tree wells to clear up the sidewalk space to make sure it's as unobstructed as possible. We've recessed benches and trash receptacles and things like that behind a consistent line of planters, and so there's predictability of where the through zone is, and we really try to minimize the number of conflicts in the pedestrian zone as we possibly can.
Okay, thank you, Neil. So I'd like to move on to Peter Albert. And so Peter, can there we go, sorry. So Peter, on the Treasure Island, I was curious if you could give us an update on activity there. A lot has changed since in terms of, I presume in terms of funding with the unfunding of redevelopment agencies. So curious, what's the status of things with the Treasure Island project?
Thank you. Actually, I'm curious as well. I think you made a good point, Chris, that redevelopment, as we know it, is no longer a function in California. We got ahead of that. We knew that redevelopment was on the political chopping block. And so we came up with an alternative way to get development to be funded, development that has a pretty high rate of affordable housing, which is a big challenge in the development world, and come up with a funding mechanism that will allow the people who are investing in Treasure Island to see their projects through without relying on typical redevelopment tools. We're there. The project's moving forward. Our estimation is that the construction of the streets and sidewalks themselves and the shared public ways could begin as early as 2013. We expect the first residents to be able to move into the island in 2016.
Okay. Well, thank you. So then once I believe the CCB had looked previously at the shared streets concept within the Treasure Island project, could you describe how that's, what's the current design like for Treasure Island? Are they still anticipating shared streets in some aspects? If so, where and how are they being used? And not to throw too many questions at once, I'm curious how they've changed over time, and in particular in respect to feedback provided by this organization and others.
Yes, okay. The shared public way is different from a street. And the idea of the shared public way is to create circulation opportunities, pedestrians, bicycles, in a way that is not designed primarily for the automobile. We built the street network in Treasure Island to allow cars, buses, trucks to circulate, vans that don't need to use these shared public ways. So the first distinction about these ways, as opposed to some of the right-of-ways that Neil described, is that there are no garages, there are no commercial frontages, there are no reasons, really, for commercial traffic or regular traffic to use them. The design, though, is not to preclude them, but to put in all those cues that tell drivers they're entering a different kind of space, and they're entering it slowly, and there's design treatments to make it very clear for drivers to know where they should be, bicyclists to know where they should be, pedestrians get much more space, much more freedom of circulation, much more safety. The treatments that we're using include the gateway concept, that there's a very clear entrance of a shared public way as opposed to a street. The textures, the pavings, the planters, vertical elements, those are all sort of in place. Those are very much like what John Paul has circulated in the drawing, or if you want to use the model that we've left, that's a good illustration of the shared public way concept. Did I get okay. All of the aspects of your question?
Sure, and if not, we'll come back to it, but I think so. I'm curious, though, within this process, basically, the city comes up with a plan, and then it's turned over to developers. How does this evolve as it goes from your hands to the private developer to develop these spaces? Or do they follow through? Or are there checks and balances? How does that happen?
Yes. Chris, you did ask me earlier, what was the process to get to this concept as well? And we did work closely with the California Council for the Blind. We worked closely with the Municipal Railway Zone Accessible Advisory Committee. We worked directly with the Mayor's Office of Disabilities to make sure that we had feedback. And that did change some of the design concepts because the feedback shifted a use of space from this place to another place. It made it clear that some accessibility issues weren't well-defined and weren't set up as guidelines clear enough, because there is a concern that if we hand this idea over to a developer, we want the developer to be very clear on how this functions and what the design concepts are doing. So while we had the major milestone we came up against was clearing the environmental review process, and we did that last year. We got the guidelines in place well enough to talk about how the shared public way should function, but we also know there's a lot of work still to be done. So coming out of all of this has been a letter of agreement between four city departments: the Department of Public Works, which is responsible ultimately for building this public right-of-way, the Municipal Transportation Agency, my own agency, because we manage pedestrian, bicycle, automobile traffic design. We have to make sure we approve of it. The Development Office itself of Treasure Island is a co-signatory. The Planning Department is a co-signatory. And then importantly, the Mayor's Office of Disabilities is a co-signatory. We would use the Mayor's Office to help us with the process itself. One of the approvals that's required before the shared public way can be built is the outreach. And using the outreach mechanisms and using the sophisticated outreach that we get from MOD all the time, to make sure specifically that we're including the feedback from people who are going to use the right-of-way, including people represented in CCB, people represented in the Mayor's Office of Disabilities, or a Muni Zone Accessible Advisory Committee. We'll use those outreach milestones to refine the design, get it to the point where it can be built.
Okay, thank you. And I know we're quickly running out of time. This seems like a deep subject, and we don't have a lot of time, so we'll move through it quickly. Sorry about that. John Paul Scott, so you've come up with a couple times. So what is the role of the Mayor's Office on Disabilities on all of this? Could you touch on that?
We're in the process of switching seats because the microphone has a tight cord. The Mayor's Office on Disability is the champion for disability access in the city and county of San Francisco, but we're also pushing for universal design. We don't want to see the city do the minimum. We want to see the city inspire and encourage people to do better. And one of our main functions is to be a segue between the community and the different city agencies that are building projects or providing programs. So in this particular circumstance, there was some request from the individuals at the Lighthouse, as well as the California Council of the Blind, to raise this issue. What are these shared public ways? What is going on? We want to have a voice. So early in the process of the Better Streets Plan, we had meetings at the Lighthouse with members of the California Council, and it had workshops, and we vetted out some ideas, especially things that were being raised in the CCB's resolution B4. Towards the end of that document, you'll see a sort of a shopping list of concepts that they were asking us to consider. And through that, we vetted out more hard language for building blocks. Those things got inserted into the Treasure Island Memo of Understanding, but also into the Better Streets Plan. It allowed us to beta test ideas. But again, that was all very conceptual. Then when the Jefferson Street project was occurring and it was considering doing a shared public way, the ADA coordinators in the city, as well as the California Council of the Blind, raised the question again, is this the right thing to do? Do we know how to do it? And with that, we requested the planning department to consider funding and putting together a focus group that would actually look at blind and low vision advocacy in the planning process and the design process for this project. So that was one thing that we helped create. We requested the Lighthouse to put a group together of 10 consultants who would have a wide range of demographic. But this way we were able to take people out into the street and talk about these issues and talk about the resolution before, the Better Streets Plan, some research one of our interns was doing, and have a public conversation to see, did we make the right decisions, and should we be making better decisions? And I think our role is to help encourage those conversations, and through those conversations, we're doing cross-training. We're teaching the planners, the designers, and the community how to better express their design concepts when we're having these big projects.
Okay. Thank you, John Paul. And I'd like to move on now to Beth. We'll come back to John Paul if we have time. So Beth helped facilitate this workshop at the Lighthouse and also was a participant. So Beth, I was curious about, actually, were you also involved in the prior workshops concerning the shared public way?
I had not been involved in the shared public way. I did go to one of the Better Streets workshops.
Okay. So I'm curious how what your impressions were of this most recent workshop, and also what your impression of how feedback perhaps from the Better Streets workshop that you attended, how those some comments and concerns might have been addressed, and if you saw, you know, how you see the evolution of things since that time.
I think that one thing that I was really impressed with is that very early I got a call from the former director, Susan Misner, very early in November of last year talking about this. And sometimes I hear from people in the city, oh, we want to do this, we want to do that. And one of the things I tell them what our fees are and how much I think that they need to pay the participants, and I never hear from them again. Susan was like, that's all the right things. We have to do this. When can we do it? So I really applaud the mayor's office and the planning department for moving on this so quickly, because I don't even see that sometimes in the private sector. I think it opened up my eyes, certainly, to what the blind community can do when asked to. The feedback that I got from both the mayor's office and from the participants was how wonderful it was for someone to come and say, let me show you this, let me explain it, and then what do you think? And we felt that our opinions were taken very seriously, that Susan actually, when it was all over, Susan's like, okay, what is the next topic? We've got to do this again. And take into consideration, we're doing this on three Saturdays. This was three Saturday afternoons. So I think it was an extremely well done project, and I hope to see more.
Okay, great. Thank you. Let's see. I was curious, John Paul, in your role or with the Mayor's Office on Disabilities, how do these issues come to your attention? How do you recognize these things? Does the Mayor's Office on Disability anticipate them, or is it as a function of hearing from the various communities?
Because there's such a wide gambit of issues that the community wants to bring in, whether it's on mobility issues, wayfinding, major public projects like San Francisco General Hospital rebuild or shared public ways, is we try to keep our finger on the pulse of what's happening in the city and where we might see the opportunity for public engagement and advocacy. At the same time, we do get questions that come in from members of the community, like from Gene Lozano back in early fall, to say what's going on with Jefferson Street. We hear it might be a shared way. And then we'll move on that and find out what's happening and then try to create that sort of engagement. But we also have the Mayor's Disability Council, which is staffed by appointments by the mayor, who are all individuals with disabilities in a variety of disabilities. We try to have a broad demographic. And then we have subcommittees under that group in which more members of the public attend, like our physical access committee. So it's from those individuals as well. They will raise up issues or raise their hand and say, you know, I heard about this. I'm concerned about that. What about accessible medical equipment for San Francisco General Hospital? Different issues, and then we'll create a public forum for those to be vetted. And we'll seek out individuals in the community to come to those meetings and help participate in the discussion with the actual project designers.
Okay, thank you. And I've got some really burning questions that would burn through the rest of our time. So I'm going to stop myself. Some great questions left. But anyway, I'd like to turn it open it up to the floor to see if you have any questions for our panelists.
Mr. Downey?
Yes. Okay.
Where's our microphone person? It's coming. Hang on, please.
This is Mitch Pomerantz, and I guess I have an observation, and I'd like one or more of the panelists to comment on. We are seeing an epidemic in this country of texting while driving, regardless of how many states pass how many punitive laws against it. And in all of the discussion last hour, what I haven't heard is a focus group for drivers. Europe is a collectivist society. They are much more socially conscious. But even in Europe, because I chair the Mobility and Transport Working Group for the World Blind Union, there is fear among blind people in Europe about safe streets, shared streets, I should say. We are an individualistic country. People want to do their own thing. They don't want to be told what to do. And I think we're seeing an increase in basically what I call scoff laws. People aren't really adhering to the laws, particularly around texting and use of cell phones. And I guess that concerns me, because while shared spaces may work in Europe, I'm scared to death because I don't think it's going to work here. And I think there needs to be a lot more time and effort put in to really finding out, will drivers in this country put up with sharing their streets and driving more safely with pedestrians? I'm not an optimist. I don't think that's really going to happen. I think this is simply going to lead to more deaths, more injuries among pedestrians generally and blind pedestrians particularly.
This is Neil Rochowy from the San Francisco Planning Department. I agree with many of your observations. I think the much safer streets and the lower rates of accidents we witness in Europe has something to do with culture. But I also think it's because they have been working for many years longer than we have on creating an entire system of safer mobility. And where speed limits are slower, lane widths are more narrow, the traffic calming is much more aggressive. And they didn't come into this at this point 40 years ago. Many of their cities looked like ours do now, with cars clogging the streets, parked in their plazas and all over the place. But it was a conscious decision. And now they're able to look for new ways, new street designs that build upon these previous efforts. And so I have hope that some of these concepts can make it to North America. I do think they need to be supported by much more aggressive engineering on all of our streets to send a much more consistent message that safety and people matter far more than they do now. And I think at that point, I think we'll start to get a much more firm foundation to work with new and more innovative street designs like shared streets. Honestly, as a designer, and this is not as an employee of the city, I think the things that work best for San Franciscans in terms of traffic calming, what I witnessed on Jefferson Street is that the same street, when it is filled with people, even if they're just standing on the sidewalk, drivers behave differently than, say, in the early morning when there's no people around. And there is a humanization of our city that needs to occur. And the presence of people, even on sidewalks, has an effect on that. And so it's going to be a slow transformation. I agree we are working from a cultural deficit in terms of wanting to go our own way, especially on the West Coast with a little bit of a frontier attitude. But I don't think it's hopeless. And I think the quality of life in our cities depends upon us trying to humanize our streets to a greater extent than they are now. And I hope that we can achieve that.
And to the texting and sort of distracted driver phenomena, there's also the phenomena of hybrids and other electric vehicles, which, as we all know, kind of sneak up on you. And actually, the Federal Transportation and Safety Board has released a study in which they determine you're twice as cyclists are twice as likely likely to be hit by a hybrid or electric vehicle than they are a normal combustion engine. And pedestrians are half again as likely
to be struck by a hybrid vehicle. So in this context, we're also introducing hybrids, which I'm not sure of the status of things, but there was legislation passed to require that they have some audible signals as part of the vehicle. Last I heard, they were trying to sort out what that meant and what the specifications were to be. Yeah, and hopefully it'll be universal and we'll know what that sound means. Yeah. Chris, thoughts on
this? Yes. This is Eric Smiley, Redwood Empire, Santa Rosa. I would like just a little clarification on the drawings that I was looking at. You said the model will be on display later. Will there be someone around to point out what each little aspect of those exhibits are? I'd like to spend more time actually looking at it with somebody. I could see the braille, but I wasn't clear as to what is the pedestrian, what's the vehicle.
We are uncertain about that, Eric, because we weren't prepared, and we have to try to figure out what we're going to do. So I don't have an answer for you on that.
I'm interested.
I understand. For 5 or 10 minutes right after this session, we could go out to the lobby and I could show you how to read the maps.
I think it would be great if Gene or somebody could be part of that discussion and be able to share that information so that they'd be in a better position to answer questions that others might have later.
Yeah, perhaps there, after we do the introduction of our next speaker, then I can step out there temporarily and get that education. Chris,
yes.
And perhaps the panelists can answer, piggybacking on Mitch's comment about a focus group, and I think that focus group also, there needs to be a focus group, if it doesn't exist already, with cyclists to buy into this. We had that unfortunate fatality just a few days ago there at Castro and Market, which I know is a really exceptional because it's a different type of illegal bicycle, but sort of presented the attitude of a bicyclist, which did not represent all the bicyclists. Unfortunately, bicyclists are getting painted a negative brush, but I can tell you in Sacramento, I have been hit and run one time by bicyclists. So I'm just wondering if we can talk about that, getting that and seeing they buying into it in education in a community, the education bicyclists to yield the right of way too. Thank you.
Could I just tag one more thing, Jean? I think also the segues. This is GGD Marie, and I belong to two chapters, the San Francisco chapter and the Redwood Empire chapter. And I have a couple of questions, but the one of my biggest fears now going to Fisherman's Wharf are the cyclists and the Segway people. And I don't think that I've had so many close calls with the Segway people. I really am afraid. When I see them, I just stop or I look for a pole. So I really think that's very important. I was a cyclist for so many years, and I love it, and I love the freedom of that sense of flying through the streets. So I understand that, but it's really such a danger to us now. And the other question, so I wanted to know how that was going to be addressed. I was going to ask Peter or John Paul. And then Chris, just before your dog barked, you said they were very tight-lipped about the dog barked, and you didn't finish. So, thank you.
Chris, do you want to answer the dog bark question first?
Okay, I'll go for that. So I don't have an exact date as to when the results are to be announced, but I will be getting back to my source there in the UK to track that. And I also hope it's information that the San Francisco Planning Department and Mayor's Office on Disability we'll be tracking, and I'll certainly make it available to them when I receive it. it also points out, I think, the importance of within our community sort of doing our own research. I mentioned two projects in the U.S. I think it'd be important for us to get feedback on how that's going. And if anybody's going to Boston, seek out Winthrop Street in Cambridge. Check it out. See what it's like. Get some explanation. Or if we can find people, blind groups that are there locally to get their feedback on that. And in particular, find what works and what doesn't. So should we move on to the other?
Again, Peter Albert is my name. I work with MTA. Because I work at MTA, I have a lot of exposure with two groups who are tackling this issue of bike safety right now, because it, I'd say from the media, from the general perception, as someone who has almost been hit many times by bicyclists when I'm on the sidewalk, it's a concern that is only going to get more and more important as there are more and more bicyclists on the street, and there are. So the Bike Coalition is a very able and large organization that has, they see it as their responsibility to increase education and training and awareness. And they're going to take it forward, this whole education process with all their bicyclists, and they're going to wed it to an enforcement program that you can't get your right back to ride a bike, because technically bicyclists operate on licensed right-of-ways unless they pass a safety class. But more important for my organization is MTA is going to really focus on bicycle safety. There are rules about where bicycles can go. A lot of those rules are being broken. There's a lot of good people who follow the rules, but they're easily ignored in terms of the people who are breaking the rules. I think, why don't I stop with that? But I do want to point out to John Paul, because he works with me so often from the Mayor's Office on Disability, that on both of those programs, the Bike Coalition and MTA's own bicycle safety, if we could work with you and perhaps engage you professionally, and not just something that you're going to do in the margins of your time, but something you do as a funded entity in the city to help us, that would be terrific.
Thank you. we see it as a big issue as well. And one of the things the city is doing is setting up many more bike cycling tracks in the street that clearly communicate to bicycle riders, ride here. And that is helping to get people off the street, but make them feel more comfortable when they're riding on the street and they're afraid of cars. And that's part of it. It's not going to solve all the bad behavior that we see. And frankly, we're very much in support of bicyclists having to have a license and having to go through training. And we've expressed that to the Bike Coalition.
Thank you, John Paul.
Chris, I think we're going to have to unfortunately wrap it up here. Okay, Charlene asked, you got the very, very last and very short.
My question is, in thinking of the people from Europe and other areas and how people are here in the States, I'm wondering how much cultural consideration of other people is playing in. I think people from the South, when they're driving in our area, have a tendency to think if someone's there to enforce the law, they do it. If otherwise, they do what they want. Has anything been looked at as to culture versus how people drive?
Anybody want?
This is Neil again from the Planning Department. I know the Department of Public Health has held a number of focus groups on culture of driving in San Francisco, and targeting specifically people who come here as visitors. And what they have found is that people recognize that San Francisco is kind of carte blanche, that there's has been historically so little enforcement that the probability of getting caught is extremely low. And it's been like that for a number of years. That's changing. There's a much, much greater emphasis on smart enforcement on dangerous corridors, driven by the data and the greatest number of accidents. But historically, San Francisco has sort of been seen as a place where it's safe to do whatever you want. And unfortunately, our streets haven't been engineered to compensate for that. So I think there's a recognition now that that's got to change, and I'm part of a task force that is taking a much more systematic look at smart enforcement in the city. It's being promoted by the mayor's office, and the mayor himself, as well as all the relevant agencies, and we are already seeing a dramatic turnaround in the effectiveness of enforcement. It's going to take a while. I think our streets have to change as well, but I think there's a new recognition that we have to do more than we have done.
Thank you very much, and I wish, let's give our moderator and panelists a big hand.
Thank you. And we're going to go outside with the model.
Yes.
Try to find somebody at your front table that I can go over this very quickly.
Yeah.
And then we'll leave it out on display. All right?
Okay. And then I'll be out there in a few minutes just to get the exposure to it. Our next pedestrian, please do not evacuate the room. We've invited Mr. David Ledwitz, who is the management analyst of the services operations planning of the Santa Clara Valley Transit Authority. He's come here to talk about accessible transit in the San Francisco Bay Area. There's a lot of things going on, and there's multiple transit agencies in the nine counties. And we thought, since this is a statewide meeting, that let's find out what they are doing in the Bay Area, things are doing, like smart cards and so forth. So let's give our attention to Mr. Ledwitz, and his background is in the program, so you can learn a little more about him. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Gene.
You're welcome. I'll be right back. Sorry. We'll
be back. I haven't scared you away, have I?
Not at all.
Thank you. Okay. Hello. Thank you for coming today, and thank you for inviting me. My name is David Ledwitz. I work at VTA, Valley Transportation Authority, in San Jose. I'm also the chairperson of the staff level Bay Area Accessibility Commission that meets once a month at the Metropolitan Transportation Commission in Oakland. And I received the invitation for this meeting through that position. My expertise is with Valley Transportation Authority. I have been there for 15 years. But when we are talking about bus and rail accessibility, the accessibility guidelines are pretty much uniformly adopted. There will, of course, be some variations, but in general, what I say about Valley Transportation or Samtrans or San Francisco Muni can be extended to the other 18 or 19 transit operators in this region, which there are 21. Most, 90 or more percent of all ridership is on the big guys, San Francisco Muni, AC Transit, BART, Valley Transportation, and to a degree, Samtrans, where we are now. Those agencies are your 90-95% ridership. everyone else is in the, you know, little bitty percentages. So I'm going to limit my conversation to Valley Transportation Authority, Camtrans, Bottom Bulk. Okay, we now live in a time under the Americans with Disabilities Act that did not exist prior to 1990 and 1997. We live in an era where accessibility to all sorts of key activities is mandatory. We have to do it. We go back to the late 70s under the Rehabilitation Act, which required accessibility for projects receiving federal dollars, but it was limited to that. If a project did not receive federal dollars, it was a well. That changed in 1990. We go to a moment in history in Chicago. I call it the Rosa Parks moment of Chicago, where we have people using wheelchairs rolling themselves out onto the street in front of a bus and chanting, "Let us on Rosa." It all goes back to the 1950 day when the African-American lady Rosa Parks found herself a seat on the bus near the front, and a white man came up to her and said, "Hey lady, move." And she said, "Uh-uh, no way, baby." Well, maybe not, ma'am. What I like to present is, with extreme respect to that struggle, Rosa Parks was able to get on the bus. When we go back to Chicago in the late 70s, at that moment, we had people on the street in their wheelchairs who could not get on the bus. And this organization, the California Council for the Blind, represents and stands for individuals with visual disabilities who also make claims, justifiable claims, that let us on. There are many things to be able to have access to through alternative means of information provision. Active learning, practice, and proactive engagement and advocacy are what I believe some of your key principles. They are also the key principles of almost every individual with the varieties of disabilities out there. You have to get engaged. You have to be proactive. You have to learn what you need to do to get where you need to go. That has been the mode operandi of my life. That's how I live. And as a diabetic for some 30 or more years, visual disability is a somewhat potential for me as well. So when I do my work, when I practice what I preach, I see the challenges I would face if that day came where I could no longer see. So I hold it close to me. With that said, let us jump into mobility and the world. Our world requires mobility. You cannot live like you used to in just a few square mile area. You know, born and die in the same location. It used to be that way. People rarely went far beyond their homes. Now, in order to have a productive life, a work, a relationship, a social network, you have to be able to move. And there are various ways to move. And so in that context, getting down to the nuts and bolts, I want to take a look at Caltrain, Camtrans VTA, and BART. Web accessibility, operator training. All of these things are critical in how you and I use transit. The American Council of the Blind and other associations representing people with visual disabilities has taken the lead in advocating for accessible web information. Public agencies in the Bay Area and many around the state take great efforts to produce the web information that is accessible for screen readers. I am not saying that everything is perfect. Recommendations and comments from individual users about problems are critical for us to improve our web accessibility. Operator responses to our boardings and deboardings are also critical. We need customer input. If a operator doesn't do something right. Or if an operator does do something right, we need to know. So let me take a real quick run. If I'm moving too slow, just knock me on the elbow and throw something at me. I will move on. Let me ask a question, some audience participation. How many out here do ride the bus? Okay. How about BART? Okay, a big club. How about Caltrain? Occasional. What? Oh, okay, well, welcome. So I sense by your applause that you're not too upset at your service. We do try our best to equip the vehicles with automatic systems that announce stops along the route to let you know where you are. Operators can be asked to call a stop that you need. Remember that. If the annunciator doesn't work and the operator doesn't take over, we need to know about that. Call it in. Now, we also have audio info on the buses that complement the visual signs that running that they have. When a door opens, an announcement is made regarding the route and the direction. This is very important at bus stops that serve more than one route. Even for people without visual disabilities, the audio information is very helpful. Let's talk about Caltrain, the train. There are issues regarding boarding and how can a person with a visual disability find the right location to stand in order to indicate that they need conductor help to get on. There's two answers to that. There are tactile bars, strips along the platform that you can walk along or guide your cane along, that when you come to a guide strip that is perpendicular to the main one you're walking along, that is where you need to stand. I'm not the expert on the details of the narrative on this issue. Caltrain staff has indicated that they do provide detailed consultation and even station-by-station training to persons that need assistance learning a station. Next, let me take a break right now. Are there any questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a mic or
No, we're okay without a mic.
Okay.
No,
we aren't.
Oh, okay.
We need a mic, so.
I'm coming.
Okay. We're coming.
I'm Warren Cushman, and first I want to urge anyone who's writing BART and has a problem, come to the BART Accessibility Task Force. We're putting pressure on them right now. My biggest problem, and the people who live with me, our biggest problem at this point on BART is access to the station, in and around the station, essentially architectural barriers to get in and around the station, and also construction barriers to the station. So my question is, how are we dealing with the issue of anything from fare gates, accessing the fare gates, to construction problems, to path of travel issues, all of which encompass essentially physical access in and around the BART stations?
Well, what I would say is you need to work closely as you are doing with BART. I can talk briefly about BART accessibility, but I am not the expert on that answer. So I apologize. BART station agents are trained to assist people with disabilities. I know that myself, as I have received some very helpful station assistance. They get full day of ADA training. The training includes a section where they each experience using wheelchairs and vision loss, and they have to walk around their station. Station agents also get a 2-hour refresher course every 2 years. You may want to talk about your BART accessibility committee regarding training of station agents. I do want to touch up, yes, comment.
Hi, Gigi DeMarie. David, you said if there's a problem of getting on to hit the button on the platform, or is it on the train?
Okay.
And also, where do you stand after you hit it? Do you stay right there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There's a tactile bar that runs across the platform. And if you stand near there, you'll be near the blue zone. And if you need help tagging on or tagging up, when they provide you boarding assistance, let them know that. And also, if you have a particular station that you use frequently, give Caltrans staff a call and they'll take some time and give you a walking training course where everything is in your own mind map. Okay? Any more questions? Rather than me directing the conversation, how about we take some questions? Yes, I can talk about paratransit.
And the regional accessibility, so it takes 5 vehicles to get just a couple of miles.
Well, I understand your question. You want me to talk about paratransit and transfers?
Yes.
Okay, well, let's go back to why. Let me, as a transit agency person, let me explain why we have to transfer. The paratransit regulations mandate that we provide service within 3/4 mile around the bus route. We also have to coordinate with other operators regarding transfers. So, for example, I live in San Jose, and for the next 4 years, I am going to need to take a paratransit or a bus up to Fremont Park in order to get into the Alameda County territory. In 4 or 5 years, I'll get on board and not worry about it. Ha ha ha. And, no. But the paratransit provides service within 3/4 mile of a bus route. And then if you have overlapping bus routes and you get areas that are not in that 3/4 mile area, the internal area of a network, you don't need to worry about. But when you need to go to a location that Agency A does not provide services, then you have to transfer to Agency B. So if you needed to go from San Jose to Oakland on paratransit, you would need to meet another van in Fremont Bart in order to transfer, because the Valley Transportation paratransit will not go beyond because they do not have the money to pay their vehicle to go all that way up. It has to do with jurisdiction and available money and the fact that our VTA buses do not provide service beyond Fremont.
This is Charlene Ornelas again. I'm curious about, as time is going by, more and more what I term as important information, such as when the next bus is going to be there. And in North County, we now have a touch screen access to the website for the North County Transit District. If you're sighted, you can use it. If you aren't in a wheelchair, forget it. Or if you're not in a wheelchair, you can use it. But if you use a wheelchair or you're blind, you have no access to getting information about routes that sighted people and able-bodied people can get. And also there's, at some of the bus stops, they have little numbers on them, and they're way up high in the sky, and they can't be seen by people who are blind. So if you were sighted, you can call up a certain number and say, I'm at bus, and tell it you're at bus stop 391, and they will tell you exactly when your next bus will come. What is being done to make all that, what I call pertinent information, available to non-visual people?
San Francisco Muni and Samtrans have already deployed a next bus information. From my own use of it, the buttons are available at a reach level required by the regulations for individuals and mobility devices, they do have audio announcements. Another question?
That looks like that's it.
Who, where? I'm sorry, it's just I don't see.
I'm Donna Sanchez from San Jose, but I thought you were going to talk about the smart card or whatever the card is going to be,
where you take it from
one place to another, use it from one place to another.
I was hoping I could get out of the building. I was hoping I could sneak out the door. And I apologize. I apologize. We have started to implement the Clipper card program. The Clipper card is a one card that you can use to pay all your various cash or pass fares throughout the Bay Region. In VTA, you can put e-cash, or you can put a monthly pass. The regional transit discount card is now a Clipper card. You can put money on your RTC card and use it to get the discounted fares throughout the region. Is there any... Do you need any further information? Question up front?
So is that card just for BART and buses, or is it eventually going to be to paratransit also?
It is currently limited to fixed route. The various buses, BART, Caltrain, ferries, there has been discussion about paratransit, but that is not part of the program right now, and I do not know when that will be part of the program in the future.
Any other questions? If not, then we'll thank our speaker for his presentation. I think Gene stepped out to look at that device, and I think he got caught up in that. I want to thank you all for coming this morning, and please go look at the demonstration that they have. They said it's under the overhang. I guess that's out the front door. Okay. And the device that Gene is looking at, the tactile image device. Please take advantage of this opportunity. Yes. Oh. That's true. Marlena, are you in the back?
Yep, we're coming.
Okay, sorry. I'm up here with no watch. I didn't have a microphone, and yes, I do. I got a little. Well, it would be nice if you got the name of the organization correct, and that the lack of accessibility of the of that new card. You didn't address any of that.
Yeah, Marlena and Louis are on their way.
Where's Louis?
They're coming. Both of them are coming. Okay. Marie's getting them up there.
Thank you.
Uh-oh.
Is he using his GPS?
No, I got my wife. No, we're not going outside. Agnes wants to leave. Tell her to follow me. Okay, where am I parking?
Right over here, guys.
Is this where the bullseye is?
Right here. I think this is Jean's chair, so what, do you sit to the one to the right? Because I think that's where there's a microphone. Hey, you. How are you?
There's
that little Aggie's there, too.
Okay. There's a microphone here.
Right there.
Share.
Are you going first? Or
you go first. Oh. You're going to talk about what's going on. Then I can...
Okay.
I need to review a room.
You're fine. Did you find
okay.
the mic?
Yeah. First of all, I want to say good morning. I'm Marlena Lieberg, and you guys have imported me in from Seattle. Whoa, that's a reaction I haven't had before. And yeah, see, that's requires coffee or something. I don't know.
Well, I should give Marlena a proper introduction. Marlena is the secretary of the American Council of the Blind. There we go.
And thank you, Bernice. And Bernice is one of my long, long time... See, I don't say old anymore, Bernice. One of my long, long time dear friends from when she and I both lived in Washington, D.C. So it's always just really wonderful to see her. I've been asked to join your conference and convention this weekend for three things. One is that I am helping the streaming team. So hello, ACB Radio. Everybody, let's say on the count of three, let's say hello world, because you are being streamed to the world. Ready? One, two, three.
Hello world.
All right. And we're getting a lot of good feedback about the stream. So that's one of my jobs. Another one of my jobs is that I'm going to be on the program tonight and then tomorrow night. Again, you'll be sick of me by Sunday, but I promise I'm leaving. And my third job is to talk to you a little bit along with Louis Herrera about the... advisory committee for the Communications Video Accessibility Act. And I have not had enough coffee to say that more than once. So it's now CVAA. So the CVAA was signed into law two years ago in October by President Obama. And what it deals with is, of particular interest for blind folks, is really strengthening and giving us back some of what we lost in terms of provision of video description. Now, that's the same thing as audio description, but the FCC's called it video description, so we're now calling it video description. What we lost a number of years ago under the prior administration's FCC. But it goes on further to deal with how do blind people access set-top boxes, you know, all those buttons, all those menus. They don't help us much, right? Yeah, they're pretty darn frustrating, right? Yeah, so it goes on to deal with that. And perhaps equally importantly, it talks about what do blind people do to get access to emergency information that's being broadcast on the TV and what constitutes emergency information. What is that? Is a school closing an emergency? Certainly we know a tornado is. Certainly we know, you know, an earthquake is. But, you know, a forest fire? Absolutely. So to deal with all of these issues, because they all have huge technical ramifications, you know, it's easy for us as blind folks, and because we know what we want. We don't care how we get it. We just know what we want. So just do it, you know. Just give us that video description and, you know, just get about it. Well, it ain't that easy, unfortunately. And so to deal with how to begin to make it happen, the FCC put out the word that it wanted to establish an advisory committee. And I got to tell you, I am so proud to say to you that the American Council of the Blind was the only blindness consumer organization represented on that committee. Isn't that great? So, in that process, some of us applied and were accepted. And then we were assigned to relevant working groups. And I'm going to have Louis talk to you more in a bit, because my group, you don't want to hear about my group. My group was so technical, we had to talk about the pass-through process and the will we say now she is standing in the room, or should we leave out the word now and just say she is standing in the room? Oh, my word. So Louis was working on the group that really, I think, had the sexiest part. Because, not just because Louis was there, but he was working on the group that actually dealt with accessible user interfaces. But before I turn it over to Louis, let me just share with you that this committee met in person. We met three or four times at our own expense to go to Washington, D.C., and then we met at least every other week, and toward the end, we met weekly for at least 2 hours on conference calls to really come up with something that we hoped will be substantial and workable. There will be an opportunity for you as individuals to respond and to give your thoughts, and so be looking for that. We will be asking you when the next comment period opens to speak out about what you want in terms of accessibility to TVs, to the menus, to the set-top boxes, and to video description. So with that, I'm going to pass the mic over to Louis.
Okay, good morning, everybody. I can tell you that CVAA, it's too big of a statement to say in complete form, so we'll leave it at CVAA. Boy, describing my group as a sexy group was scary.
It was sexier than mine.
I have to tell you folks something. From the very beginning, I was asked to consider the needs of persons with visual impairments. Our group Our very first meeting was back on January 13th of last year. And we've met subsequently three times last year, and once this year we met in person. So altogether four times. And in addition to that, we had, as Marlena said, those weekly conference calls. And in my situation was the weekly knockdown drag out fights with the manufacturing industry. Case being because they themselves, because they're not blind themselves, they know more about our disability than we do. Therefore, we should listen to them. So they think. The unfortunate part is that for them is that while I worked in the computer industry, I have an engineering background. And I have this bad habit of wanting to go research things. So when they come up with things that they feel would work for us, my comeback to them was, blindfold yourself and show me that you can do it and I'll stop bugging you. Live in our world and show us how well you can do it. When you buy a TV as a sighted person, you look forward to looking down, pushing buttons, looking up at the screen and seeing something happen. Well, blind people don't have that luxury. And then to top it off, they like to play these guessing games when you go out to buy a new TV or a new set-top box of any kind or add-in for your devices. Because you get a remote control, and guess what? All of the buttons are all non-standard, different locations. How many of you have multiple remote controls and have an enter button that's never in the same location? So the biggest issue was this. What is it that blind people require to make the quality of TV usage and access to video emergency and those types of information, what would be required to make it happen? So we first defined what it is that we need. Then we had to define how we're going to be able to have them draft a recommendation of how to meet that need. What's going to require to make it happen, and how can we go about doing it? The biggest issue is that when you have lawyers involved on technical issues and you have people that consult with attorneys day in and day out for the manufacturing industry, every time you point out something that makes logical sense is the CVAA doesn't call for that, and legally it doesn't say that. So we're going back and forth. It got to the point where even the co-chair of my group, he decided out of pure frustration, I am now speaking as a consumer, not as a co-chair, and let them have it, which I thought was great, because it's frustrating when you're trying to explain to them a need and requirement that they themselves don't understand, because at the end of the day, should they blindfold themselves, at the end of the day, they can pull their shades off or their eye patches off and they can see again. We don't have that luxury. So it was a case of going through and defining what it is that we folks need, not you, me. I'm blind too. I may be a nerd. I may be whatever you want to call me. But just don't call me late for dinner. But I am a blind person. I do have a need. However, because the CVAA does not define visual impairment as, in their eyes, you either can see or you can't. So those of you who have partial vision, you didn't count. So I got my hand slapped for speaking up and asking the FCC to define what they mean by visual impairment and what exactly are they talking about. Does that mean that you do not use whatever functional vision you have because you can still hear something? What about if you're deafblind? All of these things had to be dealt with. At the end of our 18-month period, I feel that we have put together a recommendation where we are asking for specific methods to be implemented that will give us, the first thing is uniformity and consistency, meaning when you get a remote control for your VCR or your DVR or your TiVo box, you want to find the enter button, it's on the lower right-hand corner. I'm just using this as a hypothetical example. If you want to find out where your SAP button is, it may be a diamond-shaped button in the middle of the remote control, in the center. Easy to find. A sighted person can just look down and scroll down and see this SAP lettering and push a button. In some cases, there is a menu button, and then they go to the menus and they find it. If you don't have text audio output on your device, how are you going to navigate the menu? How many guesses do you have before you can say three strikes, you're out? So we were able to come up with a definition of what is required, would be required to make this equipment accessible. So that was that issue of making the remote control accessible. Then there was the issue of what happens to the devices that have controls on the unit itself. There was no rocket science there. Put tactile markings and use the same consistency as you use on the remote controls to make it accessible. If you use the same standard tactile markings as are being used, one of the analogies that I used in several conversations was that ATMs, point-of-sale machines, and sometimes you come across kiosks that implement the same type of tactile markings with a raised round circle that means enter. You have a line that basically means go back, or you have an X that says cancel. So there's uniformity and standardization there. So we were able to come up with something that hopefully will do that. Then, of course, we need to take into account that technology is moving into a buttonless society. And we have to think about how do we deal with this stuff? How do we know where certain buttons are going to be on this touch screen? Well, here again, the issue of consistency and uniformity came into play. And there was language that was crafted. I am not a writer by any means, and I made it clear. However, I do speak on the needs of the persons with visual impairment because I have a need. I'm a user, and I know a lot of people who, just like the sighted world, don't care what happens behind the scenes. Marlena mentioned to you about all this, you know, things that she has to deal with in the other groups that she's involved with. And believe me, I am not one to sit there and argue semantics on should we use this word over another word. No, I don't care. Just give me a tool that works. Like most people, when a sighted person goes and buys a car, they don't ask the dealer, do you use the right bolts to mount the transmission? Because if you don't, we're not going to buy the car. It doesn't work that way. They want to put in a key in the car, turn the key, get that engine going, and hope that they don't hit anybody and take off. So we want to have the ability to use the tools like everybody else. So that has been taken care of, and the language was crafted. And hopefully, when we get our second phase of this 21st century communication process, we will see how much has been either modified or how much of it we're going to have to go fight to get put back or get implemented in a way that we don't miss out on any of this stuff. Part of the problem is, as I said, you have lawyers involved and you have the manufacturing industry that is going to tell us what it is that we should have. So it's a long, drawn-out process. It's something that could be done. It's something that could be functional. And as Marlena said, when the comment period opens up, please voice your concerns. Get the information. Learn as much as you can and make your voice count because you can determine how this thing is going to go. Now, there's other issues that we have to deal with. And this has to do with how information is presented on the screen. Some of you that are partially sighted have certain visual configuration requirements, color contrast, font size. If it's a crawling banner or trailing banner, as they call them in the sighted world, and it's scrolling across the screen, how fast is it moving? Is it moving fast enough for you to be able to read it? if it's a message that pops up, a sighted person can look down, look up, see it, look down, and if they forgot what they saw, they look up again. How do you and I, as blind people, get to it? Well, we have to convince them that we needed to have a review option so that we can be able to review all this stuff. We have to be able to go navigate through and read through whatever comes up on the screen. You get an emergency broadcast, and you don't know if it's in your area because you're in a market that covers a broad spectrum like Los Angeles, where the landmass is huge. If there's a problem in Long Beach and I am in Sylmar, I want to know that it's in Long Beach and not in my area. If they're going to be broadcasting to a general population, they want to be precise. Sighted people can see that and know exactly what it is that they have to prepare for. Unless we find a button that says, you know, review this or here's how you can go into it, we wouldn't know. Then the question became, well, how will you know if something comes up on the screen? Well, they have to provide us with a method that allows us to know, alerts us that something has been put up on the screen. And there are many ways that they can do that. One of them being the voice will cut off or the broadcast would cut off and your accessible media would kick in, i.e. a screen reader. Or the other method would be to have the unit generate a tone that would be associated with an emergency broadcast. This way, you would be able to know to hit your SAP or your emergency broadcast button, captioning button of some kind, where you can go into that mode and be able to read and review what was broadcast. So these are things that are serious and need to be taken into consideration. How do we make them accessible? Briefly, I mentioned shutting off the voice. One of the key things is, overall, this thing is, those are the functional things that we need to have access to. Now the question is, how do we get access to them? Well, one proposed method is to give us text-to-speech audio. Any information that appears on the screen should be accessible by you or I and those with partial vision. Unfortunately for us, we don't have the luxury of dealing with, for me in particular, being totally blind. I don't have the ability to be able to increase the magnification or whatever, change the contrast and have it improve the braille quality. It's not going to happen. And we don't know if they're going to provide alternative media access, i.e. braille, or the ability to control how the text and background, foreground, and all that good stuff is controlled. So we are proposing, and we would like to see the implementation of what already exists. 20 years ago, they could have made an argument, they meaning the manufacturing industry, that technology is not quite there today. We can't do anything for now. That's 20 years ago. Now, we are in a fast-moving pace where technology is changing so rapidly. Bill Gates wrote a book called Technology at the Speed of Thought. Well, you know what? There's a lot to be said about that because that technology and those methods that would provide accessibility for us are here. And there's no reason why the manufacturing industry could not produce devices with text-to-speech technology that allows the average user to buy the same product as a blind person. The average user doesn't require accessibility. Do not enable it. The blind user should be able to enable or disable that as they choose. They should be able to configure it. So the key thing is, what is it that we want? We want to be able to have the ability to operate the device like everybody else. We want to be able to review the text data as it appears on the screen. We want to be able to configure the devices to meet our needs using text-to-speech and not having to be dependent on anybody else. if I am a blind person and I happen to be married to somebody who is partially sighted, who requires text-to-speech, I'm sorry, screen magnification and large font accommodations, we should be both be able to enjoy this devices and have the ability to use one machine instead of having to buy two different TV sets, two different DirecTV boxes, because it's either one or the other. We need to be able to have those functional capabilities and be able to configure to meet our needs. They can set up multiple profiles. That's fine. However, give us the tools. Let us deal with that and make it accessible. One of the things is that was talked about and is becoming an issue was how do we handle multiple devices such as a DVR, or you plug in another third-party product. How will it be able to give you feedback? The intent at one point was to have each device provide its own text-to-speech. Now picture you have a DirecTV box, a DVD box, and your TV, and all three start talking at once. How do you control that? How do you know where you're at? It was kind of a stupid thing. So I raised the question, and I asked, how come there isn't a separate screen for each thing that a sighted person hooks up to their TV? They have one screen, and they look at everything that comes up. Why can't we have the same functional capability of being able to hear everything through the same source? So it became an issue. Well, the technology is not here. I said, oh, yes, it is. We have that. We do this with computers. When we go on the internet and we go to buy something at Target or we go to buy something at QVC, we don't have a secondary speech source. We use the same screen reader. The speech technology could be done, and we discussed this at length, and I had long discussions with some of our manufacturing cohorts in this group. Ultimately, they understood the idea that this is not as difficult as they made it out to be. The question is, will they buy into it? So the plan is to have one source of control, one source that will allow you to switch between the various modes, give you feedback, and allow you to have the same ability to control just like everybody else. Am I leaving anything out, Marilena?
Thank you.
And you're out of time? I'm sorry. No, actually, if I've said anything and you have any questions, please raise your hand.
Can I just say one thing? And I know that the time is escaping us here, but there is going to be, and I don't know if you know this yet, Louis, maybe you do, there is going to be a challenge. One of the trade associations last week submitted a waiver to the FCC, a request for a waiver to give them until something like 2017. So I'm telling you guys, when we call you, we need you. When we call you for comment and input, we're definitely going to need you. So everybody's hungry, so I'll shut up.
So, yes, I have heard about that, Marlena. And there's a lot of people that want waivers. The thing is that we've been screwed with too long, and we need to just unite and speak and make our voice count. Individual people can make noise, but a group can force the issue. And the technology is here, and there's no reason why they cannot implement it. Look what Apple has done for us in the last 5 years, 6 years. Look what Microsoft's been trying to do for us for the last 30 years. And the manufacturing industry has the ability to provide this stuff. The technology is here. The resources are here. It's just a matter of them wanting to do it, or the government forcing the issue by mandating that they must comply with this. So hopefully this waiver will not go through and they'll have to comply with it. So any questions? Okay, Bernice wants to know who my co-chair was. Actually, I had a great co-chair, a person from Motorola, and representing ACB was Brian Charlson. So Brian Charlson did a good job, and Jeff is very open. Actually, Jeff, even though he's in the manufacturing industry, he's very open and understands the needs. Of course, he has to look in terms of what's in the interest of the industry and what can they do to meet us halfway. But we had to kind of, well, I had fun going head-to-head with these people to a point. It got to the point where I was getting to the point where I was like, uh-oh, they're going at it again to try and shortchange us. But hopefully that will not happen.
And my co-chairs were... a gentleman from Comcast and Paul Schrader from AFB. And let me tell you, Paul and I took no prisoners and took no CRAP. And the co-chairs of the other group were Melanie Brunson, our esteemed executive director, and a gentleman from the National Association of Broadcasters. And Melanie did a fabulous job with her group as well. So we have a lot of work to do, but, you know, we're still at it.
So it's great to work with a good bunch of people, and I can tell you folks that I know in our chapter and in some of the local chapters in Southern California, I did bother some people for input on things. And it was not a bother. It was the attempt to make your needs and your voices count. So we need to continue to remain united and continue moving forward. So, are you going to the lunch? Question. Is there a microphone? Our mic runner is coming. Okay, well, our microphone runner is...
Now who's... okay.
There she is.
Let's see, who is first?
Yes, my question is, I have a 62-inch television set. I have a 35-inch television set. If they put this new stuff in, will I have to buy two new television sets?
It depends how old your TV is and what functional, what kind of a TV it is. Here's the thing. There are such things nowadays as smart TVs. I haven't found a TV that can make me coffee yet, so I don't know what they mean by that. But there is, okay, you have to think in terms of one of the things that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of is Android. Android has already released several TVs with accessibility. I have an Android TV at home. It's a Sony Google TV. It's got TalkBack built into it. It works great. It doesn't work well if you're using the old conventional analog DirecTV box, but if you use a digital box, it will read the information as you go through the menus in your DirecTV. It is pretty good. There are other TV sets out there that may have firmware upgrades that you can download and make your devices accessible. It is probable that if your 62-inch must be fairly new, and it may be that it could be upgraded. A lot of these devices will have to be evaluated, because if it's a certain age, perhaps that technology may be out of date and may not be upgradable. If there's such a thing as a accessible TV set-top box, like from your cable or satellite provider, if it is hosting all the traffic going through it, chances are that you wouldn't have to do anything but just plug in and then learn how to operate enable the accessibility and operate the device.
I just wanted to let everyone know that Louie and Marlena, of course, will be around all weekend. So if anyone has any other questions, find them and ask. And we will thank you, Marlena, and thank you, Louie, for presenting at this session. And we'll go ahead and call this session to a close and resume back in here at 1:30. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.